the next case, which is case number 80849, which is JSJBD Corp. et al. Versus Tropicana Investments LLC. And this case also is an appeal and cross-appeal situation. So as with the prior argument, each of you can reserve some time if you wish to do so. And again, you each have a total of 15 minutes. And if you reserve some time, if you say that you're going to reserve some time, then the yellow light and a tone will happen when you get to that point. But the clock keeps running, and so it's up to you to step away to actually have the reserved time. With that understanding, let's go ahead.
May it please the court, Mario Lovato on behalf of JSJBD and the related parties. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for reply rebuttal.
Okay, thanks.
First off, the district court committed error in granting essentially all attorney fees to both sides. That violates the rule that the court can grant attorney fees to the prevailing party. That's legal error because the court has discretion to grant attorney fees to a prevailing party, but not to both sides without declaring a prevailing party. And it seems that both sides in this case are in agreement that that's legal error because the other side says it's legal error on pages 44 and 45 of their answering brief. JSJBD was found to be a prevailing party on the claims that it filed. It filed three claims, and the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court said it found in favor on all three claims for JSJBD. There were four claims in the counterclaim. The district court ruled against Tropicana on three of the four claims, including the big claim for eviction. It did rule in favor of Tropicana on a breach of lease claim, a breach of contract. But in that ruling, it referred back to the declaratory relief claim that it granted for my side. And it specifically referenced the same rent schedule that it was declaring. So that breach claim is the same as my declaratory relief claim, at least as pertains to rent, where my client was seeking to affirm the lease, get a finding that the notice of termination of lease rights was invalid, and per casinari have a declaration of the amount of rent. That meant that my client wasn't getting evicted. It still had its lease rights, its option rights, etc. It had properly, to the extent it needed to, renewed those rights. We have a situation where a court hasn't done a proper prevailing party analysis. That's error. That should be reversed.
It's your position.
I'm sorry, we're both talking. Please.
Okay, I'll go ahead for now. It your position that there can be only one prevailing party on the whole case, or at least one of you, and I can't remember which at this point, mentioned the possibility of sort of dividing it up? There is some prevailing party on certain issues and another as to other issues. What's your position?
In a two-party case, the court can apportion, certainly. It would divide up by the claims and come up with an amount using the best basis it can for how much should be awarded for what defendant prevailed on, how much should be awarded for what plaintiff prevailed on. But none of that happened. There's no such analysis at all. In fact, what the court did also was find that the defendant in this case, Tropicana, the counterclaimant, didn't have to be a prevailing party to obtain fees, which is one of the more bizarre rulings that you can see from a judge. It was simply looking at the lease language, and it said that if the landlord retained counsel to address a default, he was entitled to fees. And the way the court interpreted that was that the landlord didn't have to be a prevailing party.
Oh, but given that she found that there was the amount of rent paid by your client was inadequate and awarded some rent amount to them, isn't that kind of a moot point?
Well no, because the court would have to find default. It would also have to find prevailing party status under NRS 18.010 sub 4, which has a prevailing party requirement. But the court didn't find default. It granted my client's motion my client's claim for declaratory relief, affirmed the lease rights, agreed that the notice of termination was invalid, and then declared the amount of rent.
Right.
Now, that saved my client's lease rights and option rights, including future option rights.
Yes.
Now, the declaration
it didn't reduce the rent like your client was asking to do pretty significantly.
That leads to two other errors that are interrelated. Did the court make a reasonable rent determination under Casinari? Well, the court was open about the fact that it didn't, because it decided, contrary to what it did at the summary judgment stage, to find that a September 7, 2016 letter that Tropicana sent was an agreement on all material terms. It's important to look at that letter because and understand the context of it, because anyone looking at it and applying the mirror image rule, the unequivocal acceptance rule, would see that this is not an acceptance of what was sent. What was sent by an attorney named Leslie Miller was first another amendment. There have been three prior amendments to the lease where the lease documents hadn't been updated and said there's just this little amendment. She did the same thing and sent it directly to the landlord. There was no landlord's counsel at the time. The landlord immediately rejected it. He wanted all new lease documents, not another amendment. Well, come towards the end of August of 2016, she again sends another amendment. This time, Mr. Sacco, attorney for Tropicana, attorney for the landlord, sends a response. He does not agree to the amendment. Instead, he goes through a lot of the things it discusses and proposes all new provisions.
But ultimately, doesn't Judge Gonzalez go through and she determines and she goes through the evidence she bases it on that this is a reasonable amount of rent based on all the communication, all the correspondence, all the circumstances, the history of the relationship. This is what's reasonable. And isn't that what Casinari says to do?
No. The court specifically said that it wasn't going to find an amount of reasonable rent according to market conditions because it found...
Well, does reasonable rent necessarily equal fair market value? Those are two different concepts, aren't they?
I said market conditions. Fair market value might be something somewhat different.
Okay.
Casinari refers to looking at ascertainable market conditions, and that's how reasonable rent can be determined. I think it's pretty clear from Casinari and the follow-up Bielik that you would look at the market, and that would be a substantial factor in determining reasonable rent. Now, the court said that she didn't do that because paragraph 105 of the findings of fact, she found an agreement. That agreement is based on the September 7th letter. Now, is this something that's subject to abuse of discretion? Is it something that's subject to a de novo standard? Well, it's de novo because it's in writing. It's the plain language rule. Both sides agreed that the plain language rule applied. I filed a motion for summary judgment. It was actually a counter motion for summary judgment. It was in response to a motion for summary judgment. Both sides agreed. Just look at these writings. It's a question of law. Decide whether or not this September 7, 2016 letter and any related communications constitute an acceptance. And the court found at that time, well, no, this is not an acceptance. Clearly, the landlord wanted all new lease documents. What followed this was the classic battle of forms with lease documents going back and forth, 25, 30 pages, redlined, back and forth. Nobody ever agrees on anything. And this is between attorneys.
Do you think this was complicated at all by your 30B6 witness kind of refusing to answer the majority of questions asked at the deposition and therefore not really being able to substantively provide information that could have been used at trial?
I don't. And here's why. The questions had to do with all of those lease documents. The client has a right to sign off on a lease. He is the contracting party. There is no lease, no amendment, no document in this case that was ever signed by the client. There's no express authorization that the attorneys are the contracting parties instead of the client. In a transactional matter, the attorneys are sending proposed drafts back and forth. At some point,
on behalf of their clients.
On behalf of their clients. And at some point, if they believe that they've reached a final version, it's sent to the client for signature. There is no signature here. And when it comes to the Rule 30B6 deposition, what he says is binding on the corporation. It is. And what that means is he can be confronted with his responses. And if he said, I don't know on things, that's not going to look very good to the fact finder, if it matters. But it doesn't matter when all these writings are in writing, and it's the plain language rule. When you look at this September 7, 2016 letter, You can see it says, for example, provided we are able to reach an agreement on all other points. And then he goes through all the other points. That is not an unequivocal acceptance. Anyone looking at this would reach the conclusion that Judge Gonzalez did at the summary judgment hearing. This isn't an agreement. The landlord wanted all new lease documents. And what followed this were an exchange of all new lease documents that nobody ever agreed upon. It was just redlined and redlined and redlined.
But just the fact that she didn't grant summary judgment on that, that doesn't preclude her, after hearing the evidence at trial, from reaching a different conclusion, does it?
I agree. A court can make contrary determinations on and on. The question isn't whether the court can do that. It's whether the court was correct in doing it.
Got it.
Okay. We see one instance where the court went one way. Later, the court went another. But these are all in writing. The court found this specific piece of paper to be an agreement. She also referenced an alleged phone call that came after, as if a secret oral call between attorneys, including one on our side that is no longer involved, supposedly is a binding agreement. But it was followed up by lease documents sent back and forth and back and forth, redlined and redlined, and there was never any final lease document. There was never any signed lease document. And then come August of 2017, both sides were proposing lower rent to one another. Now, at the end of August of 2017, Tony Sacco, the attorney for Tropicana, said he was done with this. He wanted to go all the way back.
Are we talking about John Sacco?
I believe it's Tony Sacco. Is it John Sacco? I'm sorry. At the end of August of 2017, he said he wanted to go back to his initial communication, which was the September 7th, 2016 letter, and be done with it with that. But what was sent to him at that point was an amendment to lease, not the lease documents that wound up being exchanged for another year and never agreed upon. Mr. Sacco never signed the amendment. He never says in here he agrees to the amendment. Now, he's the attorney, not the client. The client never signed the amendment. The client didn't want it. The client was emphatic. In his August 3rd, 2016 communication, he wanted all new lease documents. And so that's where we have error. Under the plain language, looking at this, there is no agreement between the two sides as to the amount of rent, which puts this case into Casinari. Casinari, you can have an enforceable lease with enforceable options to renew that don't state the amount of rent, likely because you don't know what the market's going to be in 10, 15 years, whenever this comes up. And if the parties can't agree on the amount of rent, then either party can apply to a court to have a reasonable rental determination by looking at ascertainable market conditions. Now, we did that. We obtained summary judgment on our side where the court said, well, there's not an agreement here. The lease is enforceable per Casinari. We're going to have a trial to determine rent. So we went to the trial, and then, of course, what we saw was the opposite. Oh, no, this letter is an agreement. But that's why we're on appeal. Under, I believe, the de novo standard, under the plain language rule that everyone agreed upon, take a look at this. Is it an agreement? Is it an unequivocal acceptance? I think anyone looking at this would see that it isn't. It proposes all manner of new terms, and it's really clear that not only is Mr. Sacco insisting that the parties reach an agreement on all these points, but he even acknowledges at the end that he's never even spoken with his opposing counsel. So there is no agreement on this, and because there's no agreement on this, and the court found an agreement, it never did the proper reasonable rental determination that's required under Casinari. So we have two items of error because of that.
So what do we do with the fact that she actually made findings that this was the reasonable amount of rent under Casinari?
Well, you have to look at what her findings are. She said, first off, in paragraph 60, that because she found an agreement, the agreement for the amount that was being paid to preserve rights is, quote, not an unreasonable amount. That's not the standard. And it's being loose with the standard. I mean, what is not an unreasonable amount of rent?
But it's kind of different. It's not that she's just evaluating the market to come up with a reasonable rent amount when the parties have provided nothing. She has some discussion about history of rent amounts, some discussion in the written documents about rent amounts, and then applying to that also reasonable market and coming up with saying that what she found was an agreement was not unreasonable at all, which is kind of the other way of saying what you've agreed upon, that I have found you agreed upon, is also a reasonable amount of rent.
Well, if there was analysis that looked at the evidence that was presented about market conditions, and the court was saying it's conducting that analysis, then that could be correct. But that's not what the court did. The court didn't cite any of the evidence that was provided on market conditions, offers, other tenants. All it cited was the two expert opinions.
Yes.
The two expert opinions, which were $1.05 per square foot per month from our side, $1.75 per square foot on the other side. And the court said, I'm not doing either of those, and I'm not going in between. I'm just going with what was paid after this letter went out. What was paid was not an agreed-upon amount. Instead, just like in Casinari, a tenant has to preserve his lease rights. He has to pay rent. If he doesn't, he doesn't have an option to renew. He doesn't have lease rights anymore. Now, what does he pay? As little as possible, or enough that he's going to be found to be in good faith? And Judge Gonzalez found that there was a good faith dispute about the payment of rent. That was part of going to the fact that she was also saying that because of an agreement, there couldn't be. Because of an agreement, there couldn't be an analysis looking at market conditions. I see I'm running out of time.
Yeah,
we request reversal. We request also remand for determination per Casinari.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor's indulgence for one moment.
Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. Terry Moore, appearing on behalf of the respondent and cross-appellant. May it please the court, I'd like to start by just addressing some of the points you were just addressing with counsel and to point out a couple issues that I think warrant clarification. And then I'm going to get into the substance of the issues. First off, as you pointed out, Your Honor, the Judge Gonzalez had very detailed findings of fact. She, in fact, contrary to what you just heard, she did make a reasonable rent determination under Casinari. That's paragraphs 89 and 90 of her findings of fact, where she says, the rent agreed to by the parties and reflected in the schedule reflects a reasonable amount of rent under Casinari. Now, that finding specifically comes after she makes the comments about the appraisers that she considered and all the evidence she heard at the end of the trial. So the Casinari analysis was done. She did make the determination that was the reasonable rent. She based it, as you indicated, Your Honor, on a number of factors, but she did make it at the end of the day say it is nevertheless reasonable under Casinari. She also did find
I have a question, Mr. Moore.
Yes, Your Honor.
From Las Vegas. On the attorney fee issue, your attorney's fee clause requires that there be a default by the tenant. And if the district court judges determination on rent, as you say, was a Casinari determination where they went to court at loggerheads on rent but on no other issues, and that's a prerogative that Casinari gives people in this position. Does that attorney's fee clause even apply to your client's claims?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, two things make it relevant. The first part is the language of the clause in Section 24 of the lease says, upon an occurrence of default, if the landlord has to retain counsel, they're entitled to their attorney's fees. The court specifically found in paragraph 92 and 93 of her findings of fact that the defendants defaulted on their lease by failing to pay the agreed-upon rent. So because of that, that justifies an award of fees under the contract. That's why when the evidence was presented, there was substantial evidence submitted both through the testimony of the tenant's representatives and through the landlord that the tenant short paid their rent towards the end of the process. And so when she made
But the court on paragraph 92 says the plaintiff has underpaid the rent in the amount of $13,000. So when you say that the court specifically found that there was a default of the agreements or covenants contained in the lease per the attorney's fee clause, you're equating underpaying the rent during the pendency of this dispute, this Casinari dispute, as a default. And indeed, you did a notice of default, but you lost on that counterclaim, which was the fourth counterclaim. So I'm a bit concerned about how we support your client's claim under the default clause again, And I don't see a default determination. I get default can mean different things.
Well, Your Honor,
I don't know who drafted the lease and whether there's any issue about who you construe it against.
The lease was drafted in 1996, Your Honor, so I don't really know who drafted it. But to address your points, Your Honor, first off, you got to read paragraph 93, which says this deviation, the failure to pay the full amount of rent under the lease, is a breach of the plaintiff's obligations under the lease. That means that is a default of their obligations under the lease. It's actually a found breach. It's more than a default. So because of that, Your Honor, that's the default. There's a finding of fact there that they defaulted by failing to pay the amount of rent that was agreed upon. So that's the basis for why Section 24 applies. Now, the other point I wanted to bring up is there was no secret oral call here. I mean, you had unrefuted testimony of Mr. Sacco during the trial that he called, confirmed with counsel for the tenant. We have an agreement on the rent. We have no problem with the rent you've proposed. And then, shockingly, the tenant paid consistent with that proposal for 2 years without objection. There's ample, substantial evidence. I choked the record with evidence on this issue below, Your Honors. And there is no doubt that the tenant performed consistent with what they agreed and what their attorney proposed, what the landlord agreed, and what their performance ratified. And so on that basis, there was substantial evidence, and there is ample evidence for you to affirm. So on that particular issue. And another clarifying point, Castanari talks about economic conditions, not market conditions. Economic conditions is a broader term, and I think that's what Judge Gonzalez looked at. She looked at the totality of the economic conditions, including the parties' negotiations, because you can't take this into a vacuum. Both in the trial below and in this appeal, the tenant is trying to get this court to give them what they could not negotiate in 2007. They specifically tried to add market rent as the factor for determining the option rent in 2007. And that was rejected twice by the landlord. There's unrefuted testimony. There's admissions by the tenant's representative at trial where they admitted, yeah, we tried to add that in there, but the landlord rejected it. And because of that, they then agreed to the landlord's language in the 2007 lease modification that says all negotiations will be premised upon terms to be negotiated, including but not limited to rental increases, thereby confirming the rent was going to go up, just like it had every other year during this 15, 20-year relationship. And that was what Judge Gonzalez found. And there's absolutely substantial evidence in the record to support that. So the next issue I wanted to point out was, I think you can affirm on the determination of the rent. I think you can affirm that the court determined, did a Castanari analysis on top of determining there was already an agreement. So under either of those bases, there was a proper determination of the amount of rent. We submitted an issue on the calculation of the damages for the unpaid rent that Judge Gonzalez respectfully just refused to change a math error. She said it was $13,000. It's $16,780. We provided her with a reference to the citation to the record and a table in the brief that showed how that error occurred. So we'd submit that that was clear error, and upon your rulings, you should determine that that amount should be increased to $16,780. From the $13,000. That was just a clear abuse of discretion. She didn't want to change her mind.
But wasn't there an offset back of about $2,100?
No, Your Honor. I'm not sure which $2,100 you're referring to there.
I thought there was an offset that Tropicana agreed to after having agreed to some reduction in the rent. So once we get to that point in 2019, there was an offset of $2,100 that went towards what would have been $16,000 and change back down to 13.
Your Honor, I honestly, I've read this whole record. I don't remember that.
So in August and September of 2019, whether there was some agreement to offset rent for 2100 because JSJBD formally indicated that its payments were made in protest. Any idea what that's about?
I think they reduced their payments by that amount. JSJBD reduced their payments by that amount.
But
that
it accounted for $2,100 that offsets what you proposed as the $16,000 and change.
Yeah, okay.
Honestly, Your Honor, the table we set forth in our brief was the one that we relied upon. That's not how I understood that particular piece of
that's
evidence.
That's okay. I don't want to get you off on math right
that's
now.
That's all right. This is why we're all lawyers and not math people.
Yes.
The next issue, Your Honor, was whether the court abused its discretion in awarding Tropicana attorney's fees under the lease. We absolutely do not believe the court abused its discretion based upon the argument I pointed out, that Section 24 complies and allows for an award of fees to my client, and that there was a finding of default justifying the award of fees. The next issue was whether there was an abuse of discretion in awarding both parties fees and costs. And on this, we're in agreement. Yes, there absolutely was an abuse of discretion. And the abuse of discretion by Judge Gonzalez was in basically saying, you're both prevailing, you both get all your fees and costs, then I'm going to do the offset.
Let me ask you about that, though.
Sure.
Is it your position that there can never be two prevailing parties? Because way back when in blackjack bonding, when we talked about a prevailing party being somebody that prevails on any significant issue,
sure.
It wasn't there can only be one prevailing party. It was just prevail on a significant issue. In Glenbrook, we talked about the ability of the courts to say nobody is a prevailing party. So impliedly in all that, isn't it open that the courts could find both sides prevail on significant issues?
So I looked at it from the perspective, Your Honor, that you in that sense, under blackjack, you had a specific statute that awarded fees for a record sealing issue. So, yeah, you could have no monetary judgment issue and still be a prevailing party if you got the records. That in that circumstance, yes, you could be a prevailing party. But when you come to both sides being awarded a monetary judgment, Perotti is very clear on how you handle this situation. You take the judgments, you offset them. Whoever's left over, you have the net monetary judgment.
The most money is the one.
You're the winner. That's who's the prevailing party. That's who gets.
But can't there be non-monetary issues that are resolved that would impact whether one is the more prevailing party?
Well, and for that, Your Honor, that's Valley Electric. And Valley Electric talks about when you're a prevailing party if you achieve a substantial result on something. But you have to look at the circumstances of Valley Electric. The person didn't receive any monetary award. So in that circumstance, you're faced with a situation where your court doesn't have the ability to do a Perotti analysis where it's an objective measure. And so the issue
but,
here...
But you agree that Perotti would have the court be netting, like your claims for attorney's fees are premised on the fee clause in your contract.
Nope.
Well, and you're netting that against attorney's fees that are being calculated by JSJBD based on 18010. So can you mix apples and oranges that way for the netting purposes on Perotti?
No, Your Honor, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is
okay.
Under Perotti, what the court should have done was take my net judgment of $16,000 or $13,000, whichever number, take his net judgment of $4,200 and change. You offset that. My client's the prevailing party because they got the net judgment of approximately $8,000. And then you determine my client's the prevailing party, and then the court does a determination, is my client entitled to costs and fees under any basis, whether it's 18010 or the lease? And that's not what happened. And I also, Your Honor...
But wait a minute. Let me just pause you. Perotti is analyzing it under 18010, which is designed to give people who don't have a large amount of money at stake the opportunity to get fees and costs. But
yes.
The court's award ultimately is discretionary. If you net and you come out ahead, the court under 18010 may award fees, but it's not obligated to do so, whereas under a contract analysis, it seems it's mandatory. So I'm just trying to figure out what you're relying on here.
She awarded us fees under both the contract and 18010, Your Honor, because she found we were a prevailing party under who recovered less than $20,000. Under either of those scenarios, we were entitled to our fees. Your Honor, I would actually like to reserve some time for rebuttal. If I didn't say
you ran out of time, so there's going to be nothing to rebut.
Oh, okay.
So go ahead. Sorry, what was I about to ask? Oh, so how would you respond to his argument that not only did he get, the few thousand dollars that were awarded as CAM charges refunded.
Sure.
Not only did he get that, but he got, the big win in this case, which is his clients got to stay there, and it was found they didn't have to vacate. They had properly exercised the option. And even though maybe it's more rent than they were proposing or thought they should have to pay, the big win is they didn't lose out on the leasehold that they had apparently paid a significant amount for.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's an excellent point. So here's the issue. The argument that we tried to evict them is a red herring because that came shortly in 2018 when their attorney was repudiating the agreement. He was their second attorney, Lewis Grower, had sent correspondence trying to basically say, we don't have an agreement here. And so the landlord at that point was like, well, I've always thought we had an agreement. If we don't have an agreement, then you're on a month-to-month, because his own attorney had sent a letter saying, we think you're on a month, we're on a month-to-month.
One of the claims from your client in this case, seeking eviction?
It was as an alternative remedy, Your Honor. We're allowed to plead alternative claims. And I want you to point out, if you look at our complaint, and you look at our, I'm sorry, if you look at our answer and our counterclaim, from the beginning in the answer and the counterclaim, we made it very clear. We think there was an agreement. We've never said that there wasn't an agreement. Their attorney came in and said, we think we're on a month-to-month holdover status. And so we pled that as an alternative. We were simply, and again, the one thing that we made clear to Judge Gonzalez, and at no point during the trial, at no point after the start of the case, was anything ever done with eviction? Was anything ever done with trying to evict them? So when you look at that, and you look at the documents, you look at the deck relief claim, which is what he's basically trying to say has the value here. You look at his allegations in his complaint, which is at the volume one, start of the very first exhibit in volume one of the appendix. Yep. When you look at those various allegations, he lost on the vast majority of those allegations in his deck relief claim. You know, Tropicana's refused to negotiate market reasonable rent in good faith. Judge didn't find that. Tropicana threatened the use of enjoyment. Judge didn't really find that. Tropicana has acted in bad faith. Judge didn't find that. And you go through, Tropicana failed to give us market rent. Judge didn't find that. But when you look at our deck relief counterclaim, most of those causes of action, allegations, the judge granted. She found there was an agreement. She found rent wasn't supposed to be based on market rent. So there were... Well,
she did find bad faith on the special damages. On the issue with respect to the CAM charges.
No, Your Honor, she did not. She did not find bad faith. She found that we breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing because we overcharged them for certain CAMs. But she did not make an express finding that there was ever any bad faith. In fact, she indicated there was a. I'm sorry, go ahead, Your Honor.
So she had a breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, but you don't equate that with bad faith.
No, because the basis was the exact reason why she found for the breach of contract, which was we overcharged for a couple CAMs on reserves, and you can't have both of those. It's either one or the other. You can't have a duplicative recovery. You can't have a breach when implied covenant says there should be literal compliance with the contract. And that's why I think we argued that the special fees issue that she awarded for attorney's fees, special damages, was improper.
Okay, so you're out of time, but let me ask one final question, which is I just want to be clear then, and I think you said this a few minutes ago, but your position as to the fee issue is that the proper analysis would be that because your client got awarded the $13,000, I know you argue for more than that, and they got $4,000 or something along those lines, because your client was awarded more, it's the prevailing party and the only party who can be awarded fees.
Under the Perotti analysis, yes, Your Honor. That's exactly what we're saying.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing on this case. We'll be in recess until...